It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, the U.S. ranks behind dozens of other countries in literacy. One in six American adults has low literacy skills. In Wisconsin, about 7% of the population has low literacy. There's a lot that goes into that, and our next guest says a big part of the solution can happen long before kids even start school. In her new book, she shares advice to help kids get ready for reading starting at age zero. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you learn how to read at an early age? How do you help your kids? Do you have questions about what you can do to build literacy skills at early ages? If you teach in preschool education or kindergarten, first grade, what thoughts do you have for parents out there on getting kids ready for reading? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maya Payne Smart is a Milwaukee-based literacy advocate and affiliated faculty in educational policy and leadership in the College of Education at Marquette University. Her new book is called Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to six. Maya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
To start with, you're kind of sounding the alarm on the importance of starting on literacy way before school starts. Tell us why that's so important.
It's so important for parents and educators and everyone really in our community to start thinking about reading with infants and toddlers, because so much brain development happens in those early years. And so much of the groundwork that supports future reading success happens long before kids can make sense of text on a page.
How much difference does it make for that kid? Say they're just hitting kindergarten. How much difference does it make to have a background in some of this pre-literacy learning that they might get from their parents or from a child care center?
It makes a huge difference. There are numerous studies that document a positive correlation between things like the number of letter names that a child knows at kindergarten entry and their reading ability down the road, because all of these skills kind of build on one another. And so the vocabulary that parents can introduce first orally, language development supports literacy development down the road. But all of those words that parents are speaking to kids, whether reading a book or just engaging in conversation in everyday life, contributes to the words that they'll be able to recognize and print down the road. And then there are so many other skills, the ability to discern sounds within words or the ability to recognize different letter shapes. All of those things contribute to reading down the road. And so it's important for parents to have an understanding of how it unfolds over time.
We'll dig into a lot of the practical advice you give in the book. One more point I want to get to before we do that is, yeah, it's been a day or two since my kids were that little. But I remember, you know, when I'd read to them, I'd like, great, this is the magic ingredient. Reading to them is going to do it. Reading your book, reading to kids is great, but we need a little more. Why isn't just reading to them going to do the job?
I think many parents are in the same boat that you were in, where you think of the book as this magical device and also this magical experience with your child. So it's just important to remember that it's really about you and the child and the relationship and that dynamic exchange back and forth with them. So the book is important to the extent that it prompts conversation and to the extent that they're paying attention to some of the print on the page. But the magic is really in that relationship. And so I, in the book, devote two chapters actually to the power of conversation and talk, just to really emphasize that point to parents, that it's not just about the words that we're saying, whether we're speaking aloud or narrating what we're doing during the day. It's about that turn-taking, the back and forth, serve and return duet of conversation with the child. And when we ask questions, it gives them a chance to formulate responses and, again, build those brain connections that are so important down the road.
Talking to Maya Payne Smart about her new book. It's called Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to six, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Were there things you did to encourage literacy, maybe for your own kids in that preschool era? Do you have questions for our guest? Are you a new parent? Maybe you need some advice. I know I did. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. And Maya, yeah, when I saw age, you know, from birth to six, I thought, well, wait, how can kids be reading at birth? Well, they can't. But you were just talking about that idea of modeling conversation, a back and forth between a parent and a kid before that kid can even talk. Could you spell out how that works?
Absolutely. So it's important for parents to recognize all of the attempts at communication that their infant is making. So while your three-month-old isn't going to respond in words or sentences, they will give you coos and babbles that indicate their engagement and indicate their learning. So if we treat those babbles as conversation or respond to those and ask questions and just proceed as if it's a typical conversation with words, we're creating so many wonderful learning opportunities for that child. And I think it's also important for parents to recognize that when the littlest babies are slapping at the book or chewing it, throwing it, all of that is important exposure to books, but also important sensory learning for the child. So don't discount that.
And speaking of those books, me reading to a kid, great. Letting the kid interact, you say, is really the key. Talk about ways we can do that starting at an early age.
Kids are learning when they're interested in paying attention and engaged. So hearing the story, they're going to pick up wonderful vocabulary and knowledge and background information. When they're older, let's say 3 or 4, and they start to pay attention to the print, and you're dragging your finger from left to right, that's teaching them something about print, or you're showing that the text moves from left to right or top to bottom of the page. There are just so many lessons within the book objects. But again, the parent brings the lesson alive by paying attention to the child, noticing what they're interested in, and responding with words and gestures.
And so it can be things like point at the dog or help me turn the page or whatever is age appropriate, right?
Absolutely. And the age appropriate piece is so important because there's so much growth and development that happens from birth, which is why I started the book mentioning from birth all the way to 6 years, because learning does look different at different ages. That 12 to 14 month old may be pointing to familiar characters or objects in the book, or they might point to things that they want you to name. They may be beginning to hold a crayon and make marks, the beginning of writing. So when parents have a little more knowledge about what's going on developmentally with children, they're better able to help the child get to the next level. And to your point earlier, we're not advocating that babies can read, but we are saying that parents can nurture future reading through this type of engagement.
One big theme in your book, I think parents might hear this and think, oh my God, I'm already trying to feed my kids and make sure their sheets are clean and whatever, and to have a job and things like that. I can't do hour-long reading lessons every day too. A lot of the stuff, so much of the stuff you're talking about is stuff we can work in to our daily routines, right?
Yes. And there are so many opportunities in the day to build these things in. When the child is waking up or at a mealtime or bedtime or bath time or any of those routine moments, all of those everyday occurrences can be reminders to engage around language. One of my favorite examples is, I talk in the book about phonemic awareness, which is building awareness of the sounds within words. And I talk about how to do that with nursery rhymes and songs and wordplay and different things. And one parent, as a reminder to sing nursery rhymes, got a changing pad for their diaper changing station that had nursery rhyme imagery printed on it. And so it was just couldn't be a more timely reminder. So we often think of reminders on our calendars and clocks and things like that. But those physical reminders in the space where you're engaging in something with your child every day anyway are great opportunities to teach in a fun, playful way.
It's Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask
Hello.
About, Susan?
Hi. I'm a grandparent of a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old toddlers. And my daughter's career-minded and her husband is too. They got busy lives. I want to support them. I want to help the grandkids out learning literacy and that. I can buy them books. I can buy them gifts for reading and that, but it may sit there. Do you have any tips on grandparents, how they can support this lifestyle?
Grandparents. Absolutely. Grandparents are so critical. Both of my daughter's grandmothers have played a major role in her literacy development. Even to this day, she's now entering 5th grade and is in a book club with one of her grandmothers. So grandparents, we encourage you to get involved as much as you can. But you can teach vocabulary as well, just in your conversations with the little ones and labeling and pointing and asking questions and being sure to keep the conversation going and giving them opportunities to respond and all of that grandparents can do. And you can also teach some of these lessons. You mentioned your grandchildren were 3 to 4 years old. That's prime time to start bringing their attention to print. Many parents don't realize that often when you're reading picture books with kids, they think the story comes from the pictures. They're not always aware that the story lies in those black marks on the page. But even without a book in hand, if there's a stop sign or words on a graphic t-shirt, whatever print is in their environment, you can teach little lessons by just describing that those letters are all made of lines, dots, and curves, and saying, oh, look at that A, it's made with 3 lines, 2 long ones that go this way and this way, and you know, trace the short one in the middle. But that talking about letters and print, naming them, getting them to pay attention to those shapes, all of that really contributes.
Susan, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Maya Smart about her new book, Reading for Our Lives, with advice on building literacy skills for kids even before they go to school. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember learning to read? Were there key things that you think helped you along the way or that you had trouble with along the way as a parent or grandparent? How have you worked to try to help your kids get ready to learn to read? Or do you have questions for our guest on how to do this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with literacy advocate Maya Smart about her new book, Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to 6. You can join in with your experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Christina is with us in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. Well, I have been sending colorful cards to my 4-year-old niece ever since she was little. I write a detailed message. She has kept all of those cards, and she'll take them out, and she will read stories. She'll make up stories about what I've said, or she'll look at the colors of the cards or the animals, and she will just talk about what's going on in the card. And that has really kept us connected with each other. And I think it's made her very articulate.
I love it, Christina. Thank you so much, Maya. That fits into a lot of things you talk about in your book, including community, connection with other people as being something that helps develop literacy.
Absolutely. Parents are stressed and starved for time and dealing with a lot of different things. So when you recognize that you don't have to do it all on your own, that you can rely on your network, your relatives, your neighbors and friends, librarians, pediatricians, and this bigger and bigger universe of people who are all supporting your child as a reader, it makes things easier. But connection, communication, all of those things that engage the child and get them interested in print and reading and writing, it's all wonderful.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Your guest has spoken of talking with a child or reading to a child, but I wonder where does someone or a family comes from a culture of an oral tradition of telling stories? Where does that fit in?
Well, interesting. Tom, thanks. Maya, any thoughts on that?
Yes, an excellent question. And oral storytelling and those rich family and cultural traditions are so wonderful, and they also contribute to reading success. We just have to be clear on the contribution they make. So obviously they make contributions to that child's vocabulary and their cognitive skills, critical thinking, social connection. But what they're not going to get from oral storytelling is that familiarity with print. So they're not going to learn that text moves from left to right and top to bottom of the page. They aren't going to gain familiarity with recognizing the letters in print. So continue with the storytelling, absolutely, and know that it has value and is wonderful and contributes to their ability to understand what they read down the road, and also just to have all of this rich vocabulary and background knowledge to build upon, but know that they also need print awareness, which can come from books or, as I mentioned earlier, text that appears on cereal boxes or T-shirts or in other contexts.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Maya Smart about her book, Reading for Our Lives, A Literacy Action Plan from Birth to Six. Maya, before we go back to our callers, I wanted to get your advice for, say there's somebody out there listening, they're a parent, and they're thinking, hey, I never developed good literacy skills myself. I'm not a strong reader, maybe even a little intimidated by it. Do you have advice for them on how to help their kids out anyway?
The main advice is to play to your strengths and be confident in knowing that the conversation that you have, listening to them, responding to their coos and babbles, and other communication as they get older, all of that is valuable and supports reading and literacy as well. And then even when it comes to teaching specific literacy skills or building their awareness of letters and print, most parents, even if they aren't tremendous readers themselves, know more letters than that three-year-old or that four-year-old. So you can lean into what you do know and be sure to share that. And then you can also look to your community and support maybe story time through librarians for them to get even more exposure to language and opportunities to get familiar with books. And talking to your pediatrician about those developmental milestones and how they're tracking and where they're going and where there might be opportunities to bring in specialists or other support. So definitely do what you can, do it with confidence, do it with joy, make it playful, songs, games, all of that is wonderful.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Juanita is with us in Fitchburg. Juanita, hi.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234.
I'm hearing Juanita's radio. I guess Juanita wanted to mention using music to help words come to life. That sounds great. Let's go to Susie now in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I was going to mention when my kids were little, we used to play the alphabet game while we were in the car, whether we were in the, out in the country or in the city, they had to find the letters of the alphabet. We wanted to see, especially in town, how fast we could go through the whole alphabet. So they had to look at the signs outside and find A and then B and then sure. C and then, through all the way, obviously all the way through. Also just reminding them that, we read for a lot of reasons, not just in books,
Great. Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, I think the story is I learned my first letter was a letter K because to drive anywhere from where I was, you had to go by the Kmart. And there was a big
yes.
K. But Susie, that's a great example, Maya, of the kind of things we could do, again, without even cracking a book open.
Absolutely. Those everyday opportunities that are fun and enjoyable. So if it's a game, don't think that it's not teaching or that they aren't learning, because they absolutely are. And the more fun and engaging it is, the more time they're going to spend on task building that letter knowledge in that case. But songs, all of that is wonderful. I met someone over the weekend whose son was deemed the king of kindergarten at his school because of his strong reading when he entered school. And the mom explained that he learned it because they had a karaoke business. And he spent a lot of time watching people sing while seeing the text that they were singing, each word light up as they sang it. And so it wasn't with a book in hand, but it was still making that print sounds connection.
Excellent. Thanks for that call. I learned the rest of the alphabet, by the way, from baseball cards, the numbers too. Back to your calls now. Barb is with us in Winneconne. Barb, hello.
Hello. I'm a retired reading specialist. It's been 20 years already since I've been out, but it brought a big smile to my face when I heard Maya talk about her advice, because it hasn't changed in 30 years. It's the same things that we've been telling parents for a long time, so I'm so happy that that's what the message still is. And as far as the grandparents, the biggest reason I probably became a voracious reader was my grandmother. My grandma always had a stack of books next to her chair, and she would read that stack of books. Every week, my aunt would go to the library and look for a new stack of books for her to read, and she was having trouble finding new mysteries that Grandma hadn't read yet. But it made a big impression on me because I saw Grandma read, but I also saw Grandma really enjoy that reading.
Gotcha. Barb, thanks for the call. Maya, the idea of modeling reading for our kids, do as I do, in addition to do as I say.
I think that that's part of it. And I know my daughter learns a lot about how much we value reading from the amount of time that she sees her grandmothers and parents reading. But watching us read doesn't necessarily teach her anything. So that's why I wanted in the book to really break down those foundational skills so parents can teach with more intention in daily life. And as the caller mentioned, they are classics. Like, they're the things that it takes to become a reader are the same things that it took 30 years ago. Vocabulary, the sound awareness, print awareness, letter knowledge, making those letter sound connections. So those are all classics, and parents can benefit from just thinking about them and intentionally inserting those opportunities to teach them.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just 30 seconds or so left. Maya, can you leave us with maybe some resources for more, apart from your book, of course, where people can find more info?
Yes, I encourage parents to take a look at developmental milestones, particularly with the younger kids, so that you are tuned into how much they're growing and developing. And it just keeps in your mind this sense of progress and boosts your curiosity and interest and attention to what they're doing so that you can respond and keep conversation going and ask questions, label and point, and all of those things that we discussed earlier. You really are your child's first teacher, and you can become their best teacher when you become more intentional about it.
Maya, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Maya Payne Smart, a Milwaukee-based literacy advocate. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Reading for Our Lives, a literacy action plan from birth to six. If you still have a story to share about how you learned to read or helped someone else learn, you can still do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, when you think about birding, you may think of people taking special trips near and far to see special birds, checking cool and rare species off their list. But our next guest says there's another way to appreciate birds. Doesn't have to cost any money, and we can start in our own yards and neighborhoods with some of the local birds we might take for granted. It's slow birding, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you make a point of identifying birds at home or in your neighborhood? Do you have a bird feeder in your yard? Do you spend time watching what goes on there? Do you go to the park with the intention of observing birds? Do you have a list of birds you've seen, hope to see? Do you have ones you watch over time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joan Strassman is the Charles Rebstock Professor of Biology at Washington University in St. Louis. Her new book is called Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. Joan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Now, I'm not a birder myself, Joan, but I got to say, I do like being out and seeing a majestic, you know, bald eagle or sandhill crane or something that's unusual. Slow birding is pretty different, though. Can you talk about the basic idea of what you mean by slow birding?
So slow birding is kind of like slow food, which was a movement started in Italy in response to fast food invading their country. The way I think about slow birding is that there's so much known about the birds that are all around us. If we just connect with them a little more closely, listen to their songs, watch what they're doing, that we can get the kind of enjoyment that some people might get by burning carbon and going many miles away, right in our own yards and neighborhoods.
There are a lot of birds featured in your book, and a lot of them are not, I think, the rock stars of the birding world, robins and wrens and many blue jays, ones we might see all the time. Can you talk about what we can gain, though, if we start watching them and learning about their behavior and what it is those little birds are doing?
So every bird has its story. All of the birds in the book are common in your listening area. And they're just really fun to watch. They fight, they mate, they find a partner often for life. And they just do lots of very cool things that we can enrich our own lives by learning about.
And you feature the work of scientists and bird behaviorists who are, you say, the slowest birders of all, people who really watch birds over a long period of time. What can looking at some of their understandings of birds tell us? How could it inform us and enhance our appreciation of those birds?
Well, I just think there's so many amazing little things that people have figured out. So just to pick one example, right now we've got the dark-eyed juncos have come down from their breeding grounds further north, and they're under our feeders and all around. And Ellen Ketterson at Indiana University and her collaborators figured out that they lose so much weight overnight, it would be the equivalent of a 160-pound person losing 11 pounds just overnight. So isn't that amazing?
That is. We are talking about Slow Birding, a book by that name by our guest Joan Strassman. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you keep tabs on the birds in your yard, in your neighborhood? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dale is with us in River Falls. Dale, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, who are you watching?
I am absolutely crazy. Ask my family and my neighbors about my work from home project has been studying crows.
Oh, okay. And so you've been working at home for a while. What kinds of stuff are you learning about the crows in your yard?
Oh, don't even get me started. So first of all, I'm learning, you know, it took befriending them and actually getting to a point where we had a certain call that we would exchange, learning tons of things about the things that they love to eat, just crazy behaviors, seeing the mated pairs, et cetera. It's just incredibly fascinating.
Dale, thank you so much for sharing that. A great example, Joan. He's been watching those crows for quite a while. He's doing some slow birding there.
That's awesome. I love crows.
Yeah, and that brings us into the tactics. A lot of your book is suggestions about ways we can interact or observe birds in our backyard. Can you give us a couple starting tips, whether it's Dale's crow friends or otherwise?
So I would start by simply sitting in your backyard, on your balcony, in a nearby park, somewhere that has some natural vegetation, maybe with a cup of coffee or whatever it is you like to drink, and just listen. Pretend you're like a toddler just learning to speak. Try to hear all the sounds that you can. Open yourself to the experience and just try to decide which sounds might come from which birds. Because so often people start at a place that's really halfway through to the learning. I like to start at the beginning with sound, also with observation, but there's just something profound to me about the sound.
Well, let's hear the sound of one of the birds you write about. It also happens to be Wisconsin's state bird. Here is a robin song.
That's lovely.
Now, the story you share, the scientific story, I love this. This is one of my favorite stories in the book, and maybe all of us have thought about it. You see a robin with a worm in its mouth. How do they know these are worms underground sometimes? How do robins find the worms? You looked at some experiments to try to answer that question.
Yes, so they could hear them, they could feel them, they could see them, or they could smell them. and a couple of really fabulous Canadian researchers figured out the roles of all those different senses and found that hearing them was the first thing that robins do.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jed is with us in Couderay. Jed, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Jed?
Well, I want to thank you for taking my call, and I just wanted to share a brief story. When I was a young child, my older brother took me out in the woods, and he sat me down, and after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, things really started to reveal themselves to us, including birds. So just in honor of him, and in, you know, you're talking about slow birding, but even just staying put, and being comfortable in your surroundings, and definitely to sound as well. But this is from a long line of bird watchers. So peace and love to all birders worldwide, and to the birds as well.
Jed, great story. Thanks for sharing your origin story as a birder. And Joan, you talk about, you know, if we're in that position, we're in a backyard or the forest or whatever, you offer a couple different ways to kind of scan the scenery for birds. Can you share a couple ways we can approach that?
Yeah, so these are sort of classic animal behavior techniques where you can't really see everything at once, and that would be called ad lib, where you're just frantically trying to look everywhere and write everything down.
That's me.
And you realize you can't. So there's two other techniques. One is you just pick one bird. You watch that one bird for some certain amount of time. Maybe you take notes. Maybe you just watch it. And then you switch to another. So that would be called focal animal. And then the third technique is called scan sampling. And that is you just sort of look from left to right or right to left and just take a flash picture of what the bird is doing at the very second that you look at it. And just tabulate up those for all the birds.
Thanks again for that call. We are talking to Joan Strassman, biology professor at Washington University in St. Louis. She shares many local birds with us here in Wisconsin. We're talking about her new book, Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Do you observe birds in this kind of way? Do you consider yourself, now that you've heard the phrase, a slow birder? What do you see maybe in your backyard or in your neighborhood? Do you go to the same spot again and again and see who's there, what they're doing, what changes over the course of the day, over the course of the year? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Joan Strassman, professor of biology at Washington University in St. Louis. Her new book is Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. And you could join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your own birding experiences or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Karen is with us in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi, I just wanted to say I've been observing ever since, for about 20 years since my dog died, and the squirrel kind of saved my life. So I've been observing birds and animals out my window a lot, and I found that if you're just open to the fact that they want the same things we want, we just, you know, become interspecial, you can see what they do. Like a blue jay flies out of a peach tree and goes up on a wire and rubs its beak, well, they're using it like a napkin. to get the oil off from eating the peaches and things like that. And when little birds are flying through the air like leaves because it's so windy and they're clinging to all my windows, I feel so sorry for them. They just want help.
Karen, thank you so much for sharing that. Karen is clearly a careful observer, Joan, but she also said something I thought was really interesting. She feels this connection with nature through her observations of these birds.
Yes, I think that's a really strong point of a big advantage of bird watching, because the birds are there because they want to be. They're wild. They can leave. They can fly away in ways that we could only dream of. They're just really fantastic to watch.
Karen, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We'll go to Jim now in Stevens Point. Jim, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Apparently, I've been practicing slow birding for 30 years, although I didn't know it. And I really look forward to a day like today when it's the first snow of the year, because I've been sitting here all afternoon and all morning, and I've had, you know, hundreds of birds. It's been just great. And I went out about halfway through the big feed, and they're all out there chirping and yakking away. So you get that part of the birds when you're out there, whether you're watching, whether you're inside. And the other thing I wanted to mention was that it kind of works toward how you garden, because I've gardened for 30 years in my yard, and I've created, you know, different layers and levels of bushes and shrubs and trees. And it all kind of works, and now they're here. So it's a wonderful thing.
Jim, thanks so much for sharing that. To his second point, Joan, you talk about that in your book, making your yard, your garden more bird-friendly when you can.
Yes, I do. I think hedges and that intermediate level is really important. And also, I'd just like to say that the classic work on Cooper's hawks was done by Bob Rosenfield at Stevens Point.
I was just going to get into that since Jim was from Stevens Point. I want to listen to the Cooper's hawk and let's talk about him a little bit. And you spent some time in your book looking at the Cooper's hawk and that research you just mentioned in Stevens Point. Now, Cooper's hawk, we hear about DDT and bald eagles, of course, here in Wisconsin, around the country. The Cooper's hawk, very, very dramatically cut back in numbers, in part because of DDT. Can you talk about that Wisconsin research you just mentioned based at UW-Stevens Point?
Yeah, so Bob Rosenfield didn't really want to stay there for his PhD, and he hadn't seen a Cooper's hawk ever because they were so uncommon that he imagined they'd be in the deepest, darkest forests. But when he put ads in those little newspapers they used to throw in our yards, he found people were seeing them all over and that they were in suburban areas and that he actually had no trouble getting lots of Cooper's hawks. And he just did a fabulous study telling all about the Cooper's hawks, how they have plucking posts, how they have a long middle toe to snatch birds out of the air. It's just fabulous work. And it's just, I had such a wonderful time talking with him.
Thanks a lot, Jim, for bringing that up and giving us that place reference. That was a nice segue there. We are talking to Joan Strassman, biologist at Washington University in St. Louis. Her new book is called Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. Back to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Eau Claire. Kevin, hi.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I discovered peanuts in the shell this year. And the Blue Jays' reaction to them has just been incredible. They'll come to the shell feeder and seem to find the very largest one first. They'll pick them up, drop them, get another one. And it's just been hilarious to watch. And then also had a Cooper's hawk outside my shop this morning, as a matter of fact.
Oh, nice,
and
Kevin.
The birds all disappeared.
I bet. Kevin, thank you so much for sharing that. You got a Blue Jay chapter. Now, peanuts aren't the only thing they'll pick up and share. Blue Jays may have helped plant oak tree forests around the country.
Yeah, it's just kind of something we don't often think of, that our northern landscapes are only about 11,000 years old. And before that, Wisconsin, Michigan, northern Missouri, it was all under you know, miles of ice. And so as that ice receded, the forests actually moved north faster than you might think. And for the oaks, evidence is that the Blue Jays had a hand in that.
Yeah, so could you talk about, like, when we see an oak tree and there's acorns around it, some of the studies you reference in the book try to figure out, okay, how many of the acorns end up being snatched up and moved and maybe planted by Blue Jays? What kind of things are we finding out?
Well, so Blue Jays are major acorn predators, and they're also really good at picking the right ones. They can carry four or five in their esophagus at a time. They take the caps off. They sort of weigh them and don't take the acorns that might have weevils in them. So if you see acorns under a tree, you might check them out and see which ones you would take, whether there's lots with weevils, how easy it is or hard it is to take off the cap. And then just think of those blue jays flying, you know, a kilometer, half a mile or more to cache them somewhere that they could then find them in the winter when there's less to eat.
Thanks for that call. Vivian joins us next in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hi, two comments. One is I have a small urban lot, city lot, and I've planted things for pollinators and birds for the last 20 years. It doesn't take a lot of room. Just learn which plants will provide habitat and food. But we can learn a lot from the birds if we listen. If you hear a flock of crows being really noisy, start looking for a predator such as a great horned owl. I used to walk my neighborhood, and in the city of Green Bay, we have a lot of flat roofs in the commercial areas. Look at drugstore tops, big stuff. I used to hear nighthawks. They're not there anymore.
Vivian, thanks a lot for the call. All right, Vivian gives us a lot to work with, Joan. First of all, I've seen in our neighbor's tree crows freak out one time for an owl and one time just the other day for a red-tailed hawk in the tree. We can use birds as clues to see what else is going on in the neighborhood. Do you have other examples of that?
Yeah, the blue jays are the best signposts. And when they're yelling at something, it might be a very dark, deep tree that's really hard to see into, but sometimes it's worth spending the spending the time to see the, in my neighborhood, it would be a great horned owl hiding in there. And I agree with the caller about small lots. My city lot is only 50 feet wide, and so I've had to make every inch of it count.
Vivian also mentioned noticing changes. Now, one thing we can kind of do to level up our slow birding is to keep, you know, diaries of what we see hear and when we see it. A fellow by the name of Aldo Leopold actually developed a lot of good bird science here in Wisconsin doing exactly that. Can you talk about keeping journals and diaries of our observations?
So I just think it's really empowering to write down what you see and maybe to try to sketch the birds. But my very favorite way to do it is with eBird and to just log your observations on the free app from Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. The reason I like eBird is because it is a citizen science project where our observations go into a bigger data set. And it also lets us explore. So I've also noticed I don't see as many common nighthawks as I used to see. And I could go into eBird and just put in, you know, explore common nighthawks and then try to see if my observations fit the whole world's observations. So between eBird and the free app Merlin, which will identify songs and help you figure out what you're seeing, Those two apps are just fantastic.
Joan, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you, and hello, Wisconsin.
Joan Strassman is the Charles Rebstock Professor of Biology at Washington University in St. Louis. We talked with her today about her new book. It's called Slow Birding, The Art and Science of Enjoying the Birds in Your Own Backyard. You can keep sharing your slow birding stories, by the way. If you'd like, you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.